Good afternoon, everyone. All right, there we are. That's the title. Are a number of, it's a fairly general talk, but a number of people have contributed to this, either past or current employees or graduate students. Quick outline. I'm going to talk about soil health testing and indicators with an emphasis on the comprehensive assessment of soil health approach that we do at Cornell, how we interpret the numbers, and then I hope to get to the effective management practices on soil health and from some of the research trials. I'm going to go through some of these slides fairly quickly because it's been presented in many other places, but just to get everybody on the same page, I want to sort of explain how we've approached this. So kind of following Jerry Hatfield's first or second or third slide, so soil health, the capacity to function, right? Functions are supported by processes like aeration or root proliferation, something like that. And processes are affected by state variables. Jerry said soil properties, but it's basically the same thing, okay? And then indicators can represent these state variables. So most of the measurements that we make are measurements of state variables that we use as indicators. In a few cases, we're actually measuring the process, like with respiration. So you may be familiar with our testing approach. It used to be called the Cornell Soil Health Test, but we renamed it the Comprehensive Assessment of Soil Health Approach. And it's really kind of a framework. We started it in 2006, so it's been out there for a while, and we've kind of refined it, removed some indicators, put some other ones in. But basically, it kind of builds on the SMAF framework, the Soil Management Assessment Framework that came Susan Andrews and Doug Carlin and Cindy Cambardella. And so we measure 16 indicators that represent agriculturally and environmentally important soil processes. So again, indicators for soil processes. We selected them out of 39 variables, and so we went through a selection process. You know, can you get consistent results? Is it relatively inexpensive to measure? Some of those kind of things. And it includes the standard nutrient test. We basically said, that's a success story. We don't mess with that. So we added basically physical and biological indicators. Our focus has been on identifying the soil constraints. So where are the problems, right? Rather than sort of an overall soil health assessment, where do you have problems? Do you have a compaction problem? Do you have a low carbon problem, et cetera? And the reports, which are nine-page reports these days, include, you know, various written interpretations and management suggestions. So these are the indicators. The chemical, again, is mostly standard. And in gray, what you see here is what we call a la carte options. And so you just pay a little bit extra. So soluble salts is in many areas is not a problem, so you don't want to pay for it. But where it is a problem, you want to include that. In urban areas, you may want to include a heavy metal analysis, right? Here are the physical ones, aggregate stability, available water capacity, penetration resistant, which is the only one that's measured in the field. The rest is basically a disturbed sample that comes to our lab. And then the biological indicators, organic matter, active carbon, protein, respiration, and optional are a root disease bioassay and potentially a mineralizable nitrogen. So I'll explain them in a little bit more detail. But the idea, again, is that each of these indicators represents a process, and we attempted to have more or less all relevant processes represented by at least one indicator. All right, so that's why it's sort of a comprehensive test. So, for example, aggregate stability relates to things like aeration, infiltration, crusting, etc. All right, so just really quickly, we do a textural analysis primarily to be able to interpret the numbers. For example, aggregate stability for sand or clay would expect to be very different. So you need to adjust for that. So we use a very rapid method, not quite as precise, but given the rapidity and the low cost, it's good enough. If you do an inexpensive version, we do texture by feel, because all we need to do is classify it as fine, medium, and coarse. We're probably going to buy a laser diffraction unit because it looks awfully attractive to me. but again, it's mostly about interpreting the values. So here is some of the methodologies for aggregate stability. We use a rainfall simulation method that we developed. It's not as much standard. The Yoder method is the kind of the wash tub method. It's more common. We feel this is a better method, but I think it's not as standardized. So I think any standard test maybe wants to go with the Yoder approach, and you can buy the equipment commercially. But we do know exactly how much energy we apply, and I think it's a little bit more natural approach. The available water capacity is standard field capacity minus wilting point using pressure plates. It's very, very well established methodology. Okay, so for some of the biological indicators, one key component to this is that we're looking at organic matter, which is very important. More organic matter is better, but there's also a quality aspect to organic matter. So, for example, here you have a soil with basically the same organic matter, let's say 4.5%. You can have a factor 3 difference in protein content. So there's quantity and there's quality. So we're trying to get to some of those quality indicators. So we're measuring basically protein using some adaptations of methodologies that were in the literature. So the autoclave citrate extractable protein, Dan Mobius-Kloon worked on that. And protein, as you know, it's an important part of the organic matter, and it relates primarily to the nitrogen in the organic matter and what could potentially become available through mineralization. The active carbon test, Ray Weil has really done a lot of work on it. It turns out to be really a very useful and very low-cost test and very reproducible. So that's part of ours as well. It's a kind of a leading indicator for carbon stabilization. We do the respiration test. Just using mason jars, it's a rapid wetting approach, fairly quick, with very good results. We're using KOH traps and then an EC meter, and can be implemented very, very quickly. This one is, like I said, is an a la carte. A lot of the, especially vegetable growers, let's say organic vegetable growers, are very concerned about root diseases. So they are the ones that often are willing to pay for that. It's basically a bioassay, and then you do an assessment of the root quality, basically, looking at necrosis, looking at lesions, and things like that. So some of the other soil health tests that are not part of the cash approach that maybe should be mentioned. So the Haney test, of course, which is there's probably been a lot more Haney tests done than there have been cash tests. And it's basically, it looks at sort of the nitrogen and the phosphorus, inorganic and organic, and a respiration test. So typically they use the Solvita, which is a one-day respiration test, which I'll show in the next slide. And then there's the water extractable organic C and N component to that as well. And you can see the equation that they use for a soil health indicator. Okay. There's also fertilizer recommendations that have come with that. I think that was the more controversial part of it. But anyway, that's the Haney test. Like I mentioned, there's a kind of a commercial test out there from Woods End Laboratories. They have a respiration test, which is referred to as the Solvita test. They have paddles in a container. It's also a rapid wetting approach. And then they sort of have a variation on that, which is the SLAN test, which is basically looking at the labile nitrogen, which takes sort of the same approach, but instead of using water, you use sodium hydroxide, and then you measure how much ammonium and ammonia and amino N comes out of that. So these are fairly rapid tests, and this is available commercially, so you can just buy the equipment from them. So it looks at just respiration and sort of the nitrogen component of that. The other ones that are receiving quite a bit of attention, and I saw a number of papers and posters here, is basically fatty acid type tests. They allow you to look at the microbial community profile, so bacteria, fungi, actinobacteria, protozoa, etc. My understanding, the PLFA, I think, has been a little bit more widely adopted. My understanding is that the ELFAME is a little easier to implement. But these are... many of the soil microbiologists find these useful tests. And then there's sort of an enzymatic test, the cellulose degradation from beta-glucosidase, that is currently also part of the SMAF, or the Soil Management Assessment Framework, is included as a test in that. So just to give you an overview of all the different tests. So one of the some of the effort that went into both by Susan Andrews and Doug Carlin's group in the ARS and our work is basically how do you interpret these numbers, especially with the new indicators like active carbon or protein. We had no idea what was a low number, what's a high number, how do you interpret that. So basically we used either expert opinion, where you basically already had a good sense of good values like pH, you know, we know what's high, low, medium, etc. Or with these new indicators, we used basically a frequency distribution approach, similar to say potassium levels in blood of humans. We're basically comparing everyone to a larger population. You know, you're high relative to everyone else, kind of that idea. So the types of scoring functions, more is better with most indicators, less is better. For example, penetration resistance, so a higher number is worse, and an optimum, notably with pH and also with phosphorus because of the environmental concerns at high levels. So this approach allows us to regionalize scoring functions. So all you need to do is define the distribution function that you, for your property, say active carbon in this case, and that may be say for the Midwest or the Northeast or whatever. And then you define the two parameters that go with the normal distribution function, which is the mean standard deviation. And then you plug that into a cumulative normal distribution function. It's basic Excel spreadsheet. It's very, very simple to do and highly adaptive to various environments. The other thing that we initially sort of erroneously accepted, erroneously assumed that everybody knew that if you gave them a soil health test result that they knew what to do with it. And big mistake. You know, you really need to help people through this. So one thing is you need to have some suggestions on management recommendations. So without going through the details, but for example, if your aggregate stability is low, it says here, then there's some short-term or long-term management recommendations that come with that. And that's just kind of to guide that process. So the idea is that if you have multiple constraints, so red colors in multiple areas, you can sort of start to see what are your best options, okay? And sometimes there's overlap. All right, so now let's look at some research results. So we were in a position after 10 years, we had almost 6,000 samples analyzed. So we said, okay, let's do kind of a meta-analysis. Let's see what we can learn from that. So Aubrey Fine, who worked with me for a while, is now in Tennessee. I said, okay, let's start with the best subsets regression. And the idea was we have an overall soil health score, and we wanted to know which single indicator is the best estimator for overall soil health. So if you were to measure only one thing, what would you measure, right? And it turned out that was active carbon. Active carbon is the single best soil health indicator, and we got about 45% of the variability was explained by that one indicator, right? And organic matter was pretty good too, and respiration was also reasonably good. All right, so then we asked the question, well, if you measure only two things, you know, what should you measure? Well, it was again active carbon, but then a penetration measurement seems to be really good as well. And now we're getting about 60% of the variability just with those two measurements. Now keep in mind, we have penetration resistance at 45 centimeters and 15 centimeters, but you're still doing the same penetration measurement, right? So so then if you think about three indicators, active carbon, penetrometer, and respiration. So you see kind of the same variables come up to be the best explanatory variables, active carbon, penetration resistance, and respiration. Aggregate stability is in there, but it's a little bit further down, okay? We did some PCA analysis, and it sort of gives you some sense of you know, the level of orthogonality or lack thereof. The idea is if you measure multiple indicators, you don't want them to be highly correlated, because why measure multiple indicators? But you do kind of see that the sort of the biological indicators kind of are in one area, and the physical indicators and the chemical indicators tend to be a little bit more orthogonal because they're sort of independently managed, right? Whether you might still put a lot of fertilizer on, and you might still do a lot of intensive tillage. So they're okay. So the other thing that we were able to do, because we had quite a few samples, say, okay, let's do a regional analysis. And every sample was identified with a state. And so we could say, we looked at actually the MLRAs, the major land resource areas. We were able to kind of, look at the Northeast, the Mid-Atlantic, and the Midwest. And these are sort of average numbers. This is just published a few months ago. The big surprise to me was that the Midwestern soils were generally in much worse shape. See, where it is green is where they had sort of the highest numbers, right? Or at least A in the... So you can see, for example, aggregate stability, the Northeast had almost 49% on the average, Midwest 25%, Mid-Atlantic 42%. Available water capacity was the only thing that was higher in the Midwest, probably related to texture. But most of the other indicators, the Northeast or the Mid-Atlantic, had better soil health in general. So you ask the question, well, isn't that completely counterintuitive? Right? We always thought that these Midwestern soils were fantastic, the mollis soils and all that. So some of it can maybe explained by texture, but I also think it's primarily the cropping system. Most of our samples came from corn-soybean rotations and from the Midwest, but in the Northeast, we have a lot of dairy production, so there's rotations of corn with alfalfa, there's manure application, we have more organic farms, and so you're probably seeing that. But it does kind of confirm what Jerry was talking about. It's like, well, these Midwestern soils, they are genetically fantastic soils, but we're maybe not treating them that well, right? So that's why you need to talk to Nick Gaser here and say, what can we do about that? But this was very surprising, very surprising. Some other research, we had some plots that were in 20 years of tillage, and then 3 years ago, now 4 years ago, we introduced cover crops. It was a cocktail, sort of some grasses and some legumes. And then we did some sampling. Actually, Marcio Nunes, who's sitting right there, did the analysis. So what was kind of interesting, so here you have aggregate stability and organic matter, that we see within 3 years, we see really some benefits of the cover crops. Right, plow-till, no cover crop, plow-till, cover crop. Most of the benefits were from the plow-till versus no-till, but remember, that was 20 years of no-till, right? But especially with organic matter, we're basically, by going to cover crops, the organic matter was about halfway between the plow-till and the no-till. So we're really, the cover crops really gives you some benefit, right? The other thing that's kind of interesting about this is the additive effect. Right, so you get a benefit from no-till over plow-till, but you get an additional benefit from the cover crop. Right, and we had kind of hypothesized that a long time ago. We didn't really have good data for that. You can see that here too, active carbon. So benefit from the cover crop, benefit from the tillage, but the additional benefit from the combination. Right, and protein here, quite a bit, because we introduced and some legumes in the cover crop. So that's very encouraging. The other thing I wanted to show you was this is some data from Roper et al. From North Carolina. And we kind of looked at their data, and I think there's actually more of a gold mine in their data than even they thought, I believe. But here you see active carbon and yield from a long-term tillage trial. And so yields, this is the holy grail, right? Can you relate soil health to yield? We can do that. Wouldn't that be great? So, and this is a long-term tillage trial. This is the red is moldboard plow. This is no-till. And then this is kind of chisel disc kind of combination. And look at that correlation. Even though there's a lot of annual variability, the mean yield goes up dramatically with reduced tillage. And this is really from about 3.5 tons to about 6 tons. So this is for active carbon. The next slide shows it for all those other indicators, and I have them kind of ranked. So for corn production, the best correlation was between protein and yield. Yield was best explained by protein content in the soil. Second, active carbon. Third, manganese, that primarily has to do with returning residue. Respiration, aggregate stability, P, organic matter, and magnesium. So organic matter ranked only sixth, right? Sixth, I think it is, or seventh. Protein was the, explained it the best. And in fact, for the soybean yields, it was actually active carbon. But look at these R-squared values for mean corn yields. So mean, again, right? There's a lot of annual variability. But the relationships for corn between protein, 0.88 R-squared for the mean yield, right? Really high values. 0.85 for active carbon. For soybean yield, 0.93 for active carbon. Active carbon could explain 93% of the variability as it related to tillage, right? So we're learning something about, how different management practices impact yield, but also how it impacts these indicators. Another thing that's interesting to look at is, we focus kind of on the surface, typically the 0 to 15 centimeters. What's happening deeper in the soil profile, right? And so a long-term tillage study that also involved returning residue basically showed that the tillage effect was the greatest, and the returning the stover or not was a secondary effect, right? What I used color coding, I like color coding, to show which one was best and which one was worst, right? So these four colors. So no-till and returning the stover always gave you the best numbers in the 0 to 6 centimeters. And then no-till, not returning the stover, harvesting the stover. Then plow-till, returning the stover, plow-till, harvesting the stover, as you would expect, right? And then you go to the next layer, 6 to 18 centimeters, same, right? Now you're going to the third layer, and it's all mixed up. Why is that? Because the plow-till puts the residue, at the bottom of the plow layer, which is what this is. The interesting thing was that deeper in the soil profile, we're seeing again that no-till and returning the stover gives you benefits. So the benefits of these management practices go down quite deep into the soil. The effect is pretty subtle, but the ranking is pretty consistent. All right, so summary slide, Manny.
Yep.
Ryan, you're going to pull me off. So what are we trying to do? We're trying to measure constraints, and that gives us a lot of insights. It's good to look at an overall soil health as well, maybe give it an overall score, maybe for land valuation or whatever. But it's very valuable to look at where your problems are so you can focus your management. Process and function focused. We use nonlinear or fuzzy scoring functions. Decision process. Generally consistent and useful results. One of the advantages of having done a test for about 10 years and probably by now over 10,000 samples, you really kind of get a sense of, what works, what doesn't. That's why we change some of the indicators. And I think we're learning a lot. I think this is what we need to do. From Nick's work, we're seeing the effect of corn after corn versus corn after soybean on protein. And so we're learning so much, and we need to make these measurements so that we understand better how these systems work. Okay? So thanks very much, and sorry about going over time.
Oh, no, that's okay. Thank you, Harold.